hundreds of them with parents lost to the underground.
We need a lot of things, Caroline. But Pearl Harbor changed everything.
I can use some personal funds.
You know the rules.
Can you close the door?
He said in a voice that could only be described as tremulous.
What is it?
I braced myself against the cool marble of Roger's fireplace.
Please, not Paul.
A few things. Do you have much information on Drancy?
6 files full. Drancy, a former housing complex on the outskirts of Paris, had become a clearinghouse of sorts for prisoners from all 5 French subcamps on their way out of the country. From the few reports I'd read, it was a hellish place, a waiting room for deportation. It was under the control of the French police, but supervised by the Gestapo Office of Jewish Affairs.
Why, Roger? What did you find?
Could Paul be in such a place? True, Rena was Jewish, but did that put him at risk? She was a French citizen, after all. But even in the supposedly free Vichy zone, anti-Semitism had become the law of the new state, and foreign Jews were rounded up. The spirit of free-thinking France had seemed to disappear overnight.
Roger, just tell me. Did you find him?
Several transports have left with French prisoners to camps all over Hitler's real estate.
Paul?
Roger nodded.
Oh, no, Roger.
A group of Frenchmen was taken to Natzweiler Stutthof, Caroline. There is good evidence to suggest Paul may be among them.
I pulled a chair from the conference table and sat. The dampness from my palms left 2 silver handprints on the polished wood and then disappeared.
Natzweiler.
It was terrible news, to be sure, but oddly hopeful. For at least he was alive.
How can you be sure?
There were only a few men in Paul's transport processed at Drancy, and they all went to Natzweiler.
In the Vosges Mountains.
Natzweiler Struthof was the only permanent Nazi concentration camp in France, located 50 kilometers southwest of Strasbourg. My mind ran ahead to forced labor and corporal punishment.
Roger nodded. Near a little town my grandparents used to visit. Quaint, but isolated.
He tossed a manila packet on the table. I sifted through the documents, scanning for anything about Paul's captors. From the Royal Air Force reconnaissance photo, it appeared to be a small camp. Only 20 rows of barracks and 4 other buildings, all wedged into a walled area surrounded by thick, snow-covered forest.
So much snow.
Was Paul freezing to death while I sat in a warm office? I scanned the photo, looking hard at the groups of prisoners gathered outside, trying to spot Paul among them.
Thank you, Roger. I'll have Pia run a search on it.
No more searches, Caroline. Washington has officially broken off diplomatic relations with France.
Roger pawed through the mess of papers on his desk.
How can that be? You have to call...
Call whom, Caroline? The embassy in Paris is no more, and this office is officially closed. Just heard. I've been ordered to destroy anything of consequence.
What do we do? I asked.
Roger stood and looked out the window at the skaters.
I've been told to go through the Swiss consulate.
Please, they're in Germany's pocket.
Our flag has to come down. I'll keep the lights on as long as I can, but it won't be easy. No more funds will be transferred here until further notice.
Will we at least have contact with France?
Hopefully we'll get packets from Free France in London, but they'll have a hell of a time finding boats willing to bring them. The Swiss may come through, and the Brits have been reliable.
I appreciate your help locating Paul, Roger.
Well, there's one more thing, Caroline. About Paul.
I braced myself. What could be worse?
I found his wife's name on the deceased list. Auschwitz-Birkenau. Rina Rodier.
Rina? Oh, no, Roger. It can't be.
Typhus, or so it said. I'm sorry, Caroline.
I sat stunned. How was it possible? Poor Rina. Paul surely didn't know. Paul. How would he react to Rina's death? It was all too horrible. I picked up a magnifying glass and searched the photo. If Paul was alive, I would find him. I would be there for him if I had to swim the Atlantic. In the days that followed, I made more trips to Snyder and Goodrich. The little money Mr. Snyder provided helped keep my French family's fund afloat, and Roger didn't seem to notice. But the specter of shutting down the consulate for lack of funds loomed large. With no official contact in Paris and the rest of France in chaos, the shutdown made sense. But closing down just when people needed us most seemed so unfair. Plus, it was my only link left to Paul.
"You're going to tear our retina with all this research," said Roger one night as he headed home, attaché case in one hand, hat in the other.
"I'm fine," I said, stuffing the frustration down deep. "I guess it's just hard on the nerves, with our own Navy planes bombing German submarines in Long Island Sound. And now this news about Paul."
"I know, see? Are you going to the Vanderbilt party? You need to get out of here and have some fun."
Roger was right. I was no use to anyone, frazzled and burned out. I ran home and changed into my best black dress, slipped father's retailored tux jacket on over it, and put my hair up. Did it make me look taller? I took it down. I looked pretty good for 40 years old. By the time I made it to the Vanderbilt's brownstone home at 5th Avenue and 51st Street, just around the corner from our apartment, I was looking forward to getting out, even if it meant seeing Betty. He'd probably deny knowing me. I shuddered at the thought of seeing Jinx Whitney, for I'd inherited an intense dislike of the fatuous Whitneys from Father. I would simply avoid Jinx and reconnect with old friends. Didn't I owe it to myself to at least stay on speaking terms with society? I couldn't work all the time. The Vanderbilt's home was a lovely old place, one of the last remnants of the Gilded Age, and it was a shame to tear it down, but the area had become somewhat unfashionable, and the Queen of Fifth Avenue needed to downsize after her husband's death. She had cut her staff from 30 to 18 and moved to an even lovelier mansion. Mrs. Vanderbilt used the occasion to have one last party at the house, a fundraiser. It was a curious mix of bridge tournament, dancing, and feasting, all for $25 admission, the proceeds going to charity. It was the public's first and last time invited into those hallowed halls, and many stood and stared. A young couple, still in their hats and cloth coats, walked about the first floor, mouths agape. They ogled the gold-inlaid woodwork and caressed the onyx pillars. A group stood before a Pompeian fresco in the entryway. That foyer alone could have housed 10 needy families.
"Merle Oberon is here," said a little man, fedora in hand.
The bridge players drifted into the library and took seats at the 30 card tables under the rock crystal chandeliers. The teams were arranged according to group. Junior League, Chapin School, Collegiate, Princeton. The Chapin group was one of the largest. In front of a fireplace so large I could almost stand upright in it, two waiters in tuxedos chalked in names on an enormous bridge scoreboard that looked like the Perry Mutual machine at Hialeah. The points of a compass designated the players. North and south,
east and west. As the jeunesse dorée took their seats at the bridge tables, I wandered the dining room, lured by the heavenly scent of rib roast and popovers. Trays of cold meats and seafood on the half-shell, a stiff hothouse iris centerpiece, and a silver punch bowl of syllabub big enough to bathe in sat on a landing strip of white damask. The orchestra played Cole Porter and Irving Berlin, while a waiter stood guard, counting the silver. Since the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, it seemed every young man in New York had enlisted. Some college boys had come home at Christmas break and gone right into the service. Overnight, the armories filled with soldiers gearing up. Mrs. Vanderbilt allowed servicemen free admission to the party, and it was quite a sight to behold all of them in their uniforms. Naval aviators from Floyd Bennett Field in their navy blue jackets with gold trim discussed war strategy with Army reservists. Most of our set trained at the lovely Park Avenue Armory, drilling in that soaring hall reminiscent of Europe's great train stations. One could always tell those boys from the others, for they often had their uniforms custom made by the best bespoke tailors in New York. As long as they followed uniform protocol, servicemen could have their uniforms made of the best wools and silks, with the finest brass and tortoise-shell buttons.
"Not playing, Caroline?" asked Mrs. Stuart Corbett Custer, Mother's bosom friend.
My lips brushed the smooth powder on Mrs. Custer's cheek. It was especially good to see her that night, done up in aquamarine chiffon. She and Mother loved to tell the story of how angry Father got when they took me to the poultry show at Madison Square Garden a few weeks after I was born. They had brought me home to Southampton in a Moses basket, atop stacks of feed bags in the back seat of the car.
"Trying to give the other girls a chance," said Mrs. Custer. "Good of you, dear. You would surely skunk them all."
From the looks of the scoreboard, the bridge teams were formidable. Mrs. M. Field and Mrs. Cushing, Mrs. Noel and Mrs. Dykeman, Mrs. Tansill and Mrs. Auchincloss.
"I'm sorry Mother couldn't make it," I said. "Me too, dear. Would you mind doing the tally for me? Your mother usually does it, and you are the most honest person in this room, I'm sure of it."
"I'm happy to, Mrs. Custer."
"We're doing a 2-hour time limit. Just gather the tallies at the gong and bring me the winner. You've seen it done a million times, of course."
I dropped a pack of tally sheets and a box of little green pencils at each table and found Betty in the library, standing with Prudence Bowles, a sweet, doe-eyed Vanderbilt cousin, Jinx Whitney, a not-so-sweet Rockefeller cousin, and Kipper Lee, a dim girl with a gummy smile, one of Jinx's furies. The four stood in a huddle, something between rugby scrum and papal synod, as Jinx told a story. Was Betty still cross with me? Surely she'd soften once I made an effort.
"And then I told her," Jinx was saying, "the man is the member. We can't make an exception. I don't care if her father was the President of the United States. We're simply full up now."
Seeing her companion's eyes flash to me, Jinx turned. Jinx, who'd somehow managed to marry money, resembled a Frigidaire in both shape and hue.
"Oh, Caroline," Jinx said. "My goodness, you're in costume."
"Nice to see you, Jinx."
"Aren't you lovely in black?" Jinx said.
"Yes, you look pretty," Prue said. "It takes a certain skin tone to wear dark colors."
"True," Jinx said. "My grandmother wore that very shade for her viewing. Everyone said she looked so natural."
Prue chimed in.
"But, Caroline, of course you look lovely. You were chosen as Poppy Girl, after all."
Jinx turned away.
She still hadn't recovered from me beating her in the contest to be Poppy Girl in 1921. It had been quite an honor to be singled out from all of that year's debutantes. At 19, I became the face of the new Poppy effort, sponsored by the American and French Children's League. My photo in every magazine and newspaper to promote the sale of silk boutonniere poppies. It was all to aid wounded American Great War servicemen and sick French children back in France. "Of course, half of that poppy money went back to France," Jinx said. "To help tubercular children. It was a reciprocal effort, Jinx. Half of the proceeds from the poppies sold in France were used to mark the graves of American soldiers." "Who's ready for bridge?" Jinx said in Betty's direction. "Does anyone need a partner, Betty?" I asked. "I'm playing with Prue," Betty said, suddenly interested in the baguettes of her engagement ring. "I hate to say it, but we're full up for bridge," Jinx said with a pout. "The teams have been set for weeks, darling. I'm so terribly sorry." "Caroline's been busy at work," Betty said. Jinx stepped closer to Betty. "Who are you and Prue playing for, Betty?" "Haven't a clue," Betty said. "Not that we'll win." Betty was right. She and Prue were miserable at bridge. "Kipper and I are playing for the American Soldier Services," Jinx said. "Delightful," I said. Jinx turned to me. "You have a problem with that, Caroline?" "Well, it's just that most of that money goes to parties." "Someone has to support our troops," Jinx said. "I guess. If you call civilians drinking gin while the troops are off fighting support, then yes." "Betty, do let's partner next time," Jinx said. She fiddled with the accordion-pleated scarf at her neck, which brought to mind the undergills of a toadstool. For fun, I considered pulling the scarf tight around her neck. This crowd would be happy to see someone do that, something they'd all imagined themselves. "So where's your mother, Caroline?" Jinx asked. "Does she even come to town anymore, or just stay up in the country in that big house alone?" "The cook is there," I said. Jinx sipped her club soda through a tiny straw. "Alone with the Russian chef?" "I really need to be going," I said. "And that handsome Negro gardener? Well, times have changed." "Mr. Gardner has been a tremendous friend to our family through difficult times, Jinx. Certainly a better friend to us than many others in so-called polite society." "Caroline, I sent a check for your French children," Prue said, one hand on my arm, trying to diffuse the tension. She had a lovely feline way about her, and gave one the impression that, given the right circumstances, she would curl up in your lap and purr. "Thank you, Prue. We can use the donation." "You know, they don't allow soliciting here tonight," Jinx said. "It's printed in the program. I was thrilled to see that. There's a limit to charity." "At your house, certainly," I said. "We can't all nail ourselves to the cross, Caroline, like your mother, the wet wool type. Not happy unless she's wearing it, attending the needy." Betty stirred, shifting from one foot to the other. Breaking in new alligator pumps, or uncomfortable that my mother was being maligned. "How is Big Liz?" I asked. Jinx was named Elizabeth after her mother, who became known as Big Liz to differentiate them, a name that suited her. "Home from the ranch. You know they sell Slenderella courses by mail now." "She's loving Southampton," Jinx said. "The Murrays had her over to Gin Lane. They've gutted the place, your Mitchell cottage. They brightened it up considerably. It was so dreary, they said, with the roof practically coming down and all." "I'm happy for them," I said. So sad you had to give that place up, Jinx said. All because of your poor young lungs.
Don't you need to be getting to the tables, Betty? I asked.
Poor little you, not being able to take the Southampton air. I adore that salt air rolling in off the Atlantic. Comes all the way from Africa.
Jinx, stop, Betty said.
So your parents ended up in Connecticut because of you, Caroline?
Jinx said. What would happen if I slapped Jinx right there in front of everyone? It would feel good, my hand grazing her fat cheek.
Yes, I said. Ironic, isn't it?
Jinx said.
Honestly, Jinx, Betty said, that's enough. Ironic because, after all that, your father's lungs were the ones to go. Tragic, really.
I'm sorry for your loss, Kipper said.
It was years ago, Kipper, but thank you, I said. I can't imagine the guilt, him lying there in your apartment, nothing to be done,
Jinx said, with the pained look of concern she did so well.
I just hate the word pneumonia, and I imagine you do too, dear. Such a terrible word.
At least Betty had the good manners to look away. If you'll excuse me, I need to go. I spent most of the match eating more shrimp than was socially acceptable, and then pretending to listen to a corporate lawyer discuss his wife's difficulties with her maid dressing better than she did, while considering ways to bring Jinx Whitney down. At last, the gong sounded. I walked to the library and collected the tallies. The tension in the room palpable, for the only people more competitive than those bridge groups were Wall Street traders and Brazilian jiu-jitsu competitors. At least the Brazilians had banned eye gouging. Guests mingled close to the scoreboard, bordering on jostling but trying to appear casual while awaiting results. Jinx stood with Kipper, Betty, and Prue, and after her strenuous rounds of bridge, looked more rumpled than a Bergdorf catalog at a Smith College reunion.
"How did you do, Betty?" I asked, attempting to mend our fence. "Well, Prue got lucky on a slam." "I think we edged you out, Prue," Jinx said.
I flapped my stack of tallies.
"We'll see," I said. "You're tallying?"
Jinx said.
"Have someone double-check your math. I'd hate for you to make a mistake."
"Don't worry, Jinx," I said.
"How could anyone but you and Kipper come out on top?" I ferried the fat stack back to the powder room, a gilded affair with golden swan-headed lavatory taps Marie Antoinette would have liked, and tallied the scores. Jinx and Kipper were the team to beat, having trounced Betty and Prue. The gong together sounded, and I hurried to the library. Mrs. Custer stood with Mrs. Vanderbilt near the chalk tally board. Mrs. Vanderbilt, ablaze with old mine diamonds, was lovely in steel-gray taffeta and matching turban. Was it the champagne or the exertion of the noblesse oblige that brought high color to her cheek?
"Come, dear, who are our winners?" Mrs. Custer asked. "I'm afraid there's no time to put it on the board."
I handed her the stack, the winning tally on top. Mrs. Custer showed it to Mrs. Vanderbilt, and they shared a smile. As I stepped to the back of the room, Mrs. Custer sounded the gong, and guests gathered from all parts of the house. Men in evening clothes gave way to those in uniform, and all craned their necks for a better view.
"It is with great pleasure that I announce the winners of tonight's bridge tournament," Mrs. Vanderbilt said. "My late husband would see this as a fitting send-off for our old place, raising $20,000 for the Red Cross."
The crowd clapped and shouted, and Jinx and Kipper edged their way to the front of the room.
"And another $5,000 to a very lucky charity. I know you're all eager to know the names of the talented winners who can call themselves the best of the best. So, without further ado, say hello to your winning team."
The orchestra played an anticipatory riff. Jinx took Kipper's hand and started toward the board.
Mrs. Elizabeth Stockwell Merchant and Mrs. Prudence Vanderbilt Aldrich Bowles.
Mrs. Custer tossed the remaining tallies in the fire as Betty and Prue pushed their way through the crowd. Mrs. Vanderbilt handed the check to Betty, who seemed nonplussed by the whole thing.
"And what charity are you girls playing for tonight?"
Mrs. Vanderbilt asked. "One close to my heart," Betty said, hand to her chest. "Caroline Faraday's French Families Fund." The crowd clapped, and the applause, polite at first, swelled as Mrs. Vanderbilt wiped a tear. Betty's smile made me glad our splinter had worked its way out. The crowd surrounded Betty and Prue, and I made my way to the door, eager to breathe the night air. On the way, I passed Jinx and Kipper.
"Sorry for your loss," I said.
"Math never was your strong suit," Jinx said. "Don't think I won't get the word out about this."
"Thank you, Jinx," I said. "I hope you do." I made it outside and tried to shake off the nipping of my conscience. So I'd been dishonest. It was in the service of a friend. I tried to focus on all the good Roger and I would do with $5,000. I walked home with a lighter step, for that night had knocked something loose in me, something long overdue to be knocked. At long last, I saw that group for what they were, with a few exceptions, a queer assortment of layabouts and late risers, most overdrawn at the bank, or at least cutting into principal, only interested in who's going in the drawer at the Maidstone Club, or their wedge on the 15th hole at Pebble Beach, or dressing down the staff about a bit of shell in the lobster while shoveling canapes in. Jinx had done me a favor, freed me of any lingering allegiances to New York society, snipped my fear of being on their bad side. I was free of spending my life pleasing them. Free to go it alone.
Chapter 19, Kasha, 1942 to 1943. When Gebhardt cracked open my cast and I saw my leg, it no longer looked like a human limb. It was swollen fat as a log, covered in dark blue and greenish-black patches. Black sutures strained to hold the flesh together along the incision from ankle bone to knee. I don't remember screaming, but later the girls back in the ward said they thought I was being operated on again, this time with no anesthesia, and others heard my screams in the courtyard at Appel. Dr. Gebhardt rolled a towel and forced it into my mouth as one of the nurses gave me a shot of something that put me to sleep. I woke up back in the ward, my leg wrapped tight in gauze, the incision feeling like a thousand knives cutting it. Susanna slipped out of bed to look at it. She pried a corner of the gauze back. "Is it bad?" I asked. "It isn't good, Kasha. I think they've removed bone, and maybe muscle." It didn't make sense. Why would muscle just be taken out of a person? What is all this for? "It might be some sort of experiment," Susanna said. "They give you tablets, but some of the others received nothing." "I'm so hot," I said. "Hang on, Kasha. Matka will help us soon." I was operated on 3 more times, and each time the suffering began anew. Each time the fevers were higher, and it was harder to recover, as if the doctors were seeing how far they could go before I'd die. By the last operation, I'd given up all hope of dancing again, and just hoped for walking. I lay on my back all day, all mixed up. Sometimes conscious, sometimes not, dreaming of Matka and Pietrik and Nadia, thinking I was back at home. I grew angrier as I lay there completely in their control. Though it was hard to track time, I knew it was the late winter of 1942, and I tried to stay positive and think of seeing Matka again. As we lay there, Regina drilled us on English verbs and told us funny stories about Freddy and his habit of climbing out of his crib. Janina taught us all French, for she'd learned many phrases working at the hair salon in Lublin. She taught us phrases such as, "This dryer is too hot,"
"Ce soir est trop chaud,"
and "May I have a cold overnight permanent wave, please, with medium curl and extra end papers?" After Janina's tutoring, I had the working knowledge of French, with a heavy emphasis on things like asking for help with dandruff. "I can't just lie around like this any longer," I said.
"Sure," Janina said. "Let's go out and ride bicycles."
"I'm serious. I have a plan." "Oh, no," Susanna said. "I think we should write secret letters home to our families." Regina propped herself up on her elbows.
"Like in Satan from the Seventh Grade? I loved that book."
What school child had not read Cornel Makushinsky's adventure story about the boy detective?
"Yes, exactly," I said. "We did it in Girl Guides."
Susanna looked up from the bread bead she was rolling for her homemade string of rosary beads. Why was she not eating that bread? Prayer had long since proved ineffective. Even my favorite Saint Agnes had forsaken me.
"That's a good way to get us all killed, Kasha," she said.
"The boy in that book used lemon juice," Regina said. "He coded his letters so the first letter of every sentence spelled out the message."
I sat up as best I could. "Our own urine would work just as well. It's acidic. We could code in letters written in urine."
"It's ingenious," Regina said.
"It's insanity," Susanna said. "Put it out of your head." Susanna was released before I was, and I missed her terribly. We heard new girls arriving in the room next door. Then one morning, Janina made a comment while old Nurse Marshall was in the room, walking about taking vitals, a towel to her nose to stem the stench. It was a harmless comment about how tired we were of being there. Nurse Marshall walked out of the room in her prickly way, and a moment later, Dr. Oberhäuser came back with her.
"Well, if you don't want to be here, then get out," Dr. Oberhäuser said. "Right now, stand up and get back to your block."
At first we thought she was joking, since none of us were fully healed. We realized she was serious when Marshall poked and prodded us out of bed.
"But we haven't been issued shoes," I began.
"Out!"
Dr. Oberhäuser said, one arm outstretched toward the door.
"Hop if you cannot walk."
I tried to stand but fell. My plaster was gone by then, but I couldn't put weight on the leg without the worst pain.
"Get up and be off with you, quickly," Dr. Oberhäuser said.
I froze there on the floor. Dr. Oberhäuser curled her strong fingers around my upper arm and pulled. She dragged me out through the Revere front entrance as one pulls carpets out on cleaning day. Dr. Oberhäuser tossed the wooden crutch out after me and left me there in the cold, the sharp slag that covered Beauty Road like glass jabbing my skin. I looked to see if Matka was anywhere around and tried to sit up. It was strange to be outside again, like being on the moon. It was cold and overcast, everything gray, and no birds flew in the sky. Pieces of ash floated in the air, like black snowflakes in a grimy snow globe, and there was a new stench. A cleaning detail was sweeping the window panes of the blocks, for black soot had drifted there the way snow does. In the distance, just behind the bunker, outside the camp walls, twin crimson tongues shot into the sky from new chimneys. You could hear the roar of that fire from almost any place in the camp. a giant belching furnace from the mouth of hell. How good it was to soon see Susanna hurrying toward me, a look of deepest concern on her face. I leaned on her as she helped me stand and take a step. Susanna, already in our new home for a few weeks, led me toward the block. I was eager to see Matka again. I hadn't taken more than one step in months, and even with a crutch, the walk was too much, especially barefoot across jagged pieces of slag. I stopped. I can't make it. Leave me, please. Come now, Susanna said as she half carried me. Baby steps. Block 31 was our new home, an international block. Some Poles, including all the rabbits, as we'd come to be known, French women arrested for working in the underground, and Red Army nurses, all political prisoners. This block was even more crowded than a previous one. Since I'd been in the Riviera, that had been a new development. Some prisoners, including the Poles, were now allowed to receive packages from their families. The soup had become even thinner by then, so it was easy to tell who was receiving food packages from home and who was not. Those who got packages walked about relatively healthy. Those who did not were reduced to skeletal wretches who lay in their bunks no longer able to clean the lice off themselves. I dozed and then woke as the girls were coming in for lunch. Susanna knelt by me and held my hand. Her friend Anise, a quick-witted, handsome woman who gave the impression she could solve any problem, stood behind her.
"We miss you," Anise said. "We have a new Blokova, Marzenka, a tough one."
"I missed you too," I said. "What is that smell outside?" Susanna squeezed my hand. "They've built a crematorium. Furnaces."
"For what?"
Susanna hesitated. "To burn," Susanna said, not able to finish. "I figured it out, of course. To burn those of us unfortunate enough to die there." "I'm sorry to tell you, sister, but everyone has heard about Luisa," Susanna said. "I thought it best for you to hear it from me. One of the Norwegian girls told me she saw her in the room they use for a morgue."
"No, it's a mistake."
Poor sweet Lou, who never hurt anyone. Pietrik would never forgive me. "No mistake. She said it broke her heart to see such a young thing lying there. Elfrida, too. Luisa and Elfrida both dead? It was hard to understand. Why had they killed such loving girls?"
"You mustn't dwell on it," Susanna said. "Only think of getting better. At least you don't have to work this week. Nurse Marshall issued you a bed card."
"Such an angel," I said. "The whole camp is up in arms over what they did to you all," Annie said. "There have been more than 50 Polish girls operated on now, and word is they're planning more. The girl guides have organized. Over 100 strong now." "We call ourselves Murray," Susanna said. "The walls." "Someone found the girl guide badge in the clothing brought back from the shooting wall, and we swear in new guides on it." "They've collected all sorts of good things for you," Annie said. "So much bread, and the French girls wrote a play for you all called The Rabbits."
"Did my mother see it?"
Anise and Susanna just looked at each other. Anise squeezed my hand.
"Oh, Kasia.
What?
Why was everyone looking so scared?
Tell me, Susanna, please." "No one has seen Matka since we were taken for the operations," Susanna said. Her eyes were glassy, but how could she be so calm? I tried to sit up, but a stab in my leg sent me back down. "Maybe they sent her to a satellite camp. Maybe she's in the bunker."
"No, Kasia," Annie said. "She was never there. We think it happened the first day you were operated on."
"How could it be? There'd been a terrible mistake."
"She's gone, Kasia," Susanna said.
"Impossible. No one saw anything. She was always so good at hide and seek, remember? The time she hid under my bed?" Kasha, Susanna said.
And we spent all morning trying to find her, and she had fallen asleep under there?
I don't think so, Kasha.
She's probably with the Bible girls, I said. Maybe Zurin has her cutting hair.
No, Kasha.
You just don't care enough to look, I said to Susanna.
Susanna pressed her homemade rosary into my hand. Of course I care. I threw it to the floor with a clatter.
You never loved her like I did.
A black ink spot grew over my face, seeping into my eyes and nose and taking me down with it.
No wonder you've given up.
Susanna retrieved her rosary.
I will forget you said that, Kasha. It's just the fever talking and the shock. Don't forget it. I mean it. I'm going back to the Revere right now to find her. I don't care if they kill me.
I tried to get out of bed, but Susanna pinned me down. I raged against her until I'd lost all strength. I slept, waking only to fall deeper into despair. It took a few days for it to sink in that Matka was not coming back. At first, I hoped that our Polish network just failed to find her and she was tucked away somewhere safe or transferred to another camp. When I asked girls from the block to help me find her, they were kind, but after a few days, it was clear they all believed she was dead. There would be no funeral, no birch cross, no black cloth nailed to our door. Before I learned to use my crutch, I depended on Anis and Susanna to carry me to and from the latrine. Janina needed an escort, too. Our helpers were gracious, but I hated being a burden. I imagined my own death. What a wonderful, quick death it would have been to throw myself on the electric fence. Of course, no one would carry me there. Until that time, all through our arrest, our arrival at the camp and the operations even, I had always found good things to think about and Polish optimism to fall back on. But once Matka was gone, I could not pull myself out of the darkness. I felt like a fish I read about when I was a child, the African mudskipper. Each year when the drought came, it burrowed deep into the mud and lived there for weeks, neither dead nor alive, waiting for the rains to come and bring it back to life. Life went on as usual after our release from the Revere, the brutal waking, the endless hours of Appel, and the most terrible gnawing hunger, our bosom companion. The only thing that interrupted this pattern was the terror that accompanied our Blokova, reading the names of those in our block to be executed. The procedure seldom varied. It was preceded by warnings from the prisoner workers in the front office that the courier had arrived from Berlin with an order of execution, and that the male guards who served as executioners had been approved for extra schnapps rations. Then Binz would order certain blocks locked down. Once the noon soup was delivered, but before it was served, the Blokova would read the numbers of the pieces to be called. The unlucky ones prepared their things, and Binz and friends came to get them shortly. My reaction seldom varied either. The cold fear my name would be called out, the relief it was not. The terrible stabs of sadness, watching a blockmate go through her final ritual. The day the first executions of rabbits were announced, we waited, barely breathing, on the benches of the dining table, packed tight, Susanna on my right, Regina to my left. Those of us who'd been operated on had just graduated to eating a table, a big event, for it meant our soup no longer had to be brought to our bunks. There were many rumors that the commandant would schedule the rabbits for execution, liquidate us to eliminate the evidence of the crime. But could we believe rumors? There was always a new one, like that the Americans were on their way to save us, or that there would be steak in the soup.
Attention, Marzenka said as two Russian girls struggled the soup boiler into the block. Heftlings with numbers called up will finish here, collect their things, and await further instruction.
Marzenka pulled a square of paper from her jacket pocket and unfolded it, the crinkling of it the only sound in the room.
Number 7649.
To my left, Regina stiffened. Marzenka read the names of three other rabbits, all still recovering in the revere. No, Susanna said. There must be a mistake. I wrapped one arm around Regina.
No hysterics, Marzenka said.
How could this be happening? I whispered in her ear. We can fight this, Regina. She didn't answer, just placed her spoon in her bowl and handed it to Susanna. I'd like you to have this, she said. Susanna took the bowl, water shining in her eyes. Such a gift. Regina stood. Janina, would you fix my hair? Janina nodded, and we followed Regina to the bunk room, bringing her full bowl with us. Since left unattended, it could be stolen in seconds. Do you know the first thing Spartans condemned to death did before their executions? Regina asked. Had their hair styled. Janina pulled Regina's dirty kerchief off. Ordinarily, fixing one's hair was a punishable offense. The rule was, hair must be kept back, tied with a regulation kerchief. But Binz relaxed the rules when the prisoner was about to die. Regina's hair had grown longish when she was recovering from her operation, thick and dark. Janina swept it back in the prettiest French twist. Someone from a top bunk handed down a hairpin she'd probably traded a bread ration for. Kasha, I want you to have my English phrase book, Regina said. Homework tonight is prepositions, and if you could get my Troilus and Cressida to my Freddy once all this is over. I nodded. I'm going to refuse the drink, Regina said. We all knew a sedative drink was offered to those taken to the wall to make things easier for all. Do you think I'll be brave enough to shout, Long live Poland? I held her hand. It doesn't matter. It does, Kasia. You know they hate that. Prisoners face death in different ways. Some cried and raged. Others grew quiet or prayed. Regina stood near her bunk and read us her favorite lines from Troilus and Cressida, rushing to fit in as much as possible before Binz arrived. O brave Troilus, look well upon him, niece. Look you how his sword is bloodied, and his helm more hacked than Hector's, and how he looks, and how he goes. O admirable youth, he ne'er saw 23. As Regina read, we pinched her cheeks to bring color to them. A girl who worked in the kitchen had some beet juice, and Janina smoothed a bit of it on Regina's lips. It wasn't 5 minutes before Binz and her guards burst into the block. Regina leaned close to me, book clutched at her chest. Tell everyone this happened, she said.
Hand it over, Binz said. She snatched the book. What are you so worried about? The commandant himself has said you are to be freed.
Was that possible? Surely it was another lie. Janina untied the string from her own waist and cinched it around Regina's, making her uniform look more like a real dress.
Out! Out! Binz said, jabbing at Regina with a rubber stick.
Regina limped to the door, her leg not yet fully healed. At the door she handed her reading glasses to Susanna and turned to smile at us. She'd taken on a radiance, a new sort of glow, and there was high color in her cheeks. Binz tossed the book to an officerin and pushed Regina out to the road. Not one prisoner who watched Regina go could keep from crying. How brave she was! The name Regina means queen, and this was fitting, for she looked regal that day. If not for her uneven way of walking, Regina could have been a movie star or fashion model, standing tall and proud on her way down Beauty Road. With heavy hearts, Susanna and I shared Regina's soup with Janina. How guilty we felt eating that. But she'd not meant for it to go to waste. We split the sweet little carrot. Such a delicacy. I would get strong on Regina's soup and live to tell the world about it all. Soon, Susanna and I reported to the Strickerei to knit, but we listened all afternoon, hoping not to hear the shots. Maybe Binz was right, and the girls were being released, sent to a sub-camp. Later that day, we heard a truck drive toward the lake, and four muffled shots, one after the other. And we prayed silently to ourselves, for praying was a punishable offense. Later, Anis told me she'd heard from the girls working in the kitchen, which was adjacent to the shooting wall, that Binz had taken all four of the rabbits there for execution. One had to be carried, her wounds not healed enough for her leg to support her. "We wept," they told her, when all four of them cried, "Long live Poland," at the end. After that, I could no longer just be angry and not act. Would we be the next to go to the wall? Who would be left to tell the world? Even if it got me killed, I would launch my plan. That Sunday, while Susanna slept trying to shake a nasty case of dysentery, I loosened the boards above an upper bunk and shimmied up into what we called the annex, an attic of sorts, where girls went to smoke cigarettes sometimes. With my bad leg, just getting up into the annex was an ordeal. There was little light up there to see, and my eyes adjusted to the dark as I assembled my tools for the secret mission. 1. A letter I'd written in German on a single page of camp stationery, in which the first letter of each line spelled out, "Letter written in urine." 2. The toothpick I'd paid half a bread ration for. 3. My water cup, into which I sent my warm secret ink. My first tries left puddles on the page, but I soon grew better at writing between the lines and wrote of the operations and the names of the rabbits who'd been executed. Regina first, then Romana Sekula, Irena Porbotsovna, Henrika Dembowska. It felt good to tell Papa about the firing squads and the operations and ask him to send word to everyone he could. By then, 70 of us had been operated on. It would take many more letters to get Papa all the names. I asked him to send back a spool of red thread as a signal he had received and understood our secret letter. The next morning, we woke to a cold drizzle and lined up 10 abreast at Appell, waiting for letter collection before we went to the Strickerei for work. I kept my letter dry under the sleeve of my jacket. As Marzenka came down my row to collect letters, I took it out and ran my finger over it. It was just a bit warped from where urine met paper. Would Marzenka see? The censors? Marzenka stepped closer and stretched out her arm, her palm up. My hand shook as I placed the letter on her palm. A gasp caught in my throat as the letter slid off and fluttered toward the ground. "Clumsy," she said. I lunged to catch it as it fell, but it ended up on its back in the mud. "I'm not touching that," Marzenka said. I picked the letter up and wiped the mud off with the hem of my dress and handed it to her. "Please, Madame Blokova." She took it with two fingers and squinted one eye. "Why so worried about one little letter?" She held the letter up to the spotlight overhead. I could barely breathe. She handed it back. "You address it to the Lublin post office. Take it back." I kept my hands clasped behind me. In care of Adalbert Kuzmeritsk. My father works there, Madame Blokova.
Oh,
Marzenka said. She slapped it onto her pile and moved on. I wished that letter safe travels on its way. Be careful with it, Marzenka. It's our only chance.
Chapter 20. Pata. Christmas, 1943. Come Christmas of 1943, morale among Ravensbrück staff hit a new low. Earlier that year, German troops had fought hard at Stalingrad, despite being underclothed and underarmed, but in the end capitulated. We also faced increased Allied bombing in Berlin, but our troops retaliated in Great Britain, and we seized control of northern Italy and rescued Mussolini, who had been arrested by the Italian military. So there were still things to celebrate. As the war dragged on, though, life at Ravensbrück grew more difficult. Fresh transports arrived around the clock, loaded with infected prisoners from the Führer's conquered territories. Without Halina, the Revier was a madhouse, teeming with disease carriers from every country. There was little time to spend missing Fritz or Mutti. I stayed in my office most days, but the place had to be managed. The camp doctors in particular needed a break, and we received one in the form of an especially fine Yuletide celebration. Across Germany, citizens suffered with reduced rations, but the camp staff still enjoyed real coffee, salami, Polish vodka, and good champagne. Our party began with a pageant. Binz and her guards shuffled into the canteen dressed as angels, in white satin robes tied at the waist with golden ropes. She'd even convinced me to wear one such outfit, which was good, because the bell sleeves covered the few cuts on my arms and helped me avoid embarrassing stares and questions. This cutting of mine was a phase, a typical tensional outlet, not surprising given the stress of my duties. Binz and each angel on her staff wore a foil headpiece with a cross rising from the forehead and carried a tall pole topped with a gold-painted swastika that almost scraped the low ceiling. As they filed in, each lit a candle on the tree in the corner, which was fitted with candles on every branch and strewn with the usual silver tinsel threads. Then SS men entered, dressed as shepherds in costumes of robes and long headpieces made of shimmering blue material. Bringing up the rear of the procession was Commandant Suren, our Father Christmas on stilts. He wore a long red felt robe, trimmed with white fur, and carried a rod in one hand. He tipped his pointy cap forward to enter the doorway.
"Who's been naughty or disobedient?" he shouted, a twinkle in his eye.
Soon Father Christmas threw down the rod and opened his sack of sweets. Where was he getting such treats in wartime? Beer, the chosen beverage of the group, flowed freely. Even Father Christmas had a mug. When the new religion ushered in by National Socialism first appeared, it had seemed strange, but one adjusted. According to the Führer, one could be a German or a Christian, but not both. He suggested we be Christ ourselves, which seemed a practical solution. Many German people resisted this change, but all members of the SS converted to this new religion. Gradually, religious aspects of Christmas were replaced with symbols of nationalistic pride, and we celebrated the winter solstice instead of Christ's birth. Soon, even Father Christmas was replaced by Odin, the solstice man. Mutti chafed at all this, for she was raised a devout Protestant, and my father a Catholic, but eventually even Mutti had both a people's tree, topped with a Germanic sun wheel, and a tradition.